Blog Talk Radio.
About as many area codes that's in the phone book, or do we have phone books anymore? I don't think we do. But at any rate, our panel is all lit up with area codes from around the country. Let's start off with Steve Thompson up there in Roaring Gap, North Carolina. Steve, tell us about your conditions there. Give us a weather report.
Hi, Neil. Hi, listeners. It is cold, to put it very bluntly, here in the mountains of North Carolina. The highest forecast tomorrow is 23 degrees, and it is cold and windy.
Okay, cold and windy for Roaring Gap, North Carolina, western part of the state. And let's see, who else do I see here? I think Chuck Albright's with us. Chuck, you're in the central part of Florida. It must be Florida weather, right?
Well, it's almost Florida weather. We are having a bomb 60 degrees right now, and tomorrow it's going to sink down probably another 20 degrees from what I understand. We had a really bad storm come through today. I mean, it whipped the wind up, and, of course, unfortunately, our 53 golf courses were shut down for today. And tomorrow, only the brave is going to get out there in their cold little knickers. So it's quite balmy here today.
Okay. Well, let's move on up to Georgia, around the Atlanta area. Jim Graybill, how are you tonight? And tell us about Atlanta. Big A.
Better than the average bear here tonight, Neil. Whether you all can keep that stuff up north if you want to. It's been windy, and we're down in the low 40s. They say it's going down in the mid-20s here tonight. So.
Okay.
Get the long johns out.
Okay, I remember it. Yeah, and it won't be long before you guys will be having some ice. Atlanta's notorious about ice storms, especially around January.
They're talking about that tonight, too, Neil.
Oh, my golly, again, this early. Wow. Okay, let's move on over to... Wow, we have two area codes up in New York area, I think, out on Long Island. And the first one I see is George Jen. George, how are things over your way, up your way, I should say?
Well, good evening, Neil, and good evening, listeners. Actually, today it poured raining most of the day. It was pretty warm, but tonight it's supposed to go down to 20 degrees, so winter is almost here.
Wow, yeah. And then just a short distance from you is Frank Segnor. Frank, how are you tonight? Well, I've lost Frank. But I do have down there in your way, down your way, Jim Hart, I have Cecile Intriago. Cecile, tell us about things down in South Florida. Not as bad as the rest of the country, right?
Absolutely not. The weather is great. It was in the 80s. It rained for about...
Really great weather.
Great weather. And back to you, Neil.
Okay. All right. We have some background folks that are listening, and I've opened their microphone up, so I've closed them down. So let me remind you folks, before Jim tells you the numbers to call in, that anytime you want to add to our discussion on the radio, just click one on your telephone keypad, and it'll indicate on my brilliant board here that you want to add to our discussion. And let's see, who have I forgotten anyone? I think I've just about got it. Oh, I see Jim Hart. Jim Hart?
Yes, I'm here, Neil, in
you.
South Florida, just a little bit north of Cecile. I'm in the little town of Royal Palm Beach, which is right near West Palm Beach. And today, would you believe, we broke a record high. We were at 82 degrees here today. I tell you, it was beautiful, but I unfortunately have to stay out of the sun because of skin problems. But I want to tell you all, this is a fantastic place to be out of that snow and cold. I was born in Maine, raised in Maine, and worked for 30 years in Connecticut around the Hartford area. And, man, I appreciate being here right now. I tell you, if you folks have listened to our past shows, you know that we can be reached online during our live broadcast. Our numbers, once again, are 213-816-1611 or toll-free at 877-572-1861. Let me repeat those numbers again, please. 213-816-1611 or toll-free at 877-572-1861. And remember, when you're calling the show, make sure you press the number one button on your telephone if you wish to connect live with our show. Neil.
Well, Jim, I see another area code popped up here, 843. Is that you, Gay?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, how are things out there in the Hilton Head area?
They're good. It rained all day, and then it cleared up, and it was just beautiful sunset tonight and supposed to be cold tomorrow, and we're looking forward to a little cool weather here.
Hey, you guys, have you, I'm sure we have this, I was going to ask you a stupid question. Do you have a cell phone? Wow. Everybody, I think everybody in the world's got a cell phone. And but if you have one of these smartphones and you can get the radar on your screen, I like to, anytime I hear thunder or anytime I hear rain or whatever approaching the Jacksonville area where I am, I always turn my phone on and go to the radar or whatever they call that application. And lo and behold, I turned the phone on and looked at the radar screen there, and we had a line that stretched all the way up to you guys up in the New England area, all the way up there. But it was coming across our area, and we had a tornado here in the Jacksonville area today about 1:30. And I haven't heard about any damages, but my wife was out at the Mayo Clinic at about 3 o'clock this afternoon in the doctor's office there. And when she said she came out to her car in the parking lot, and there were a lot of limbs and a lot of trees and foliage that were all scattered all over the campus at the Mayo Clinic here in Jacksonville. We have a large Mayo Clinic area. It was the second. It was the first Mayo Clinic opened outside of Rochester, and beautiful campus here. People come to it from all over the world. So I'm interested in the news show tonight to see the damages that. I hope not many folks had trees through their housetops and that type of thing, but usually resulting from tornadoes. But just don't like to see those.
It was on TV today.
Was it? And but
yeah,
to see that, Yeah. Oh, you saw it all on TV. Okay.
Yeah, it was on TV up here.
Wow.
From your store
yeah.
down there.
Okay. Well, I told my wife when she left this afternoon after she came from the Mayo Clinic, she came back here to the office, our studios, and I said, honey, go home and make sure you call me if there's any damages to our new house, because we just moved in it last April, and we have this real tall pine tree that's probably about 20 yards from the back of our house, and I know that thing is one of these days is going to come down, and I certainly hope it doesn't come across our house. But it stands all by itself. There's a pine forest, and all of the other pine trees are about half the height of that one that towers above all of them. So we kind of worry about that. And again, just a reminder, folks, our listeners, you can always tune us in by going to EALRadioshow.com and just click the arrow in the radio icon. Or you can go to our sponsor, Retired Eastern Pilots Association, which is the REPA website. And there you can click the radio show's icon on the homepage. And the site is www.repaonline.com. And or you can go to the server that provides the service for our broadcast every Monday evening. And that's www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie, and we abbreviate Captain, of course, CAPTEDDIE. And that's...
Neil, let's start the engine for our show tonight.
Okay, enough talking. Let's start that engine. And I hope we've done a little maintenance on it, but let's see how it sounds tonight.
Clear.
Yeah. It's a what engine?
Our 1959, maybe a 404 or a Connie or a DC-7.
Well, it's anywhere from a 2800 all the way up to a 3350 engine, I guess. What did you say, Chuck?
It's a 3360
engine. All right.
Sounds like
turbo compound.
Yeah.
And if you guys wouldn't quit over boosting it, it wouldn't go bad.
I remember the old conveyors. You had to keep that little finger on the primer, and you always had to prime that engine to get those 2800s going. Right, Steve?
Sure did. Yep. That was a real art.
Yeah, it sure was. Well, let's see.
Conveyor 440s. That was I think everybody started it on a primer.
You had to prime that, and you had to know how to prime it. I mean, you almost had to be part of the engine. Your brain had to be part of the engine. Well, let's see. What's our show about tonight? Let's talk about our show. Jim, whatever you and our host and listeners want to talk about, that's what we'll talk about tonight. I've got a few suggestions.
Great, Neil. Many of us have so many things that took place during our years at Eastern. I think that Steve has a fantastic thing he wants to talk about. Right, Steve?
Yes, I do, Jim. Whenever my time is ready, I would like to share some of the excerpts from the book that I am working on, which I anticipate to be released about 2040 or 2050. at the rate that I'm putting it together. So,
is this going to be something that you release in the afterlife?
At the rate it's going, I think it will be.
Well, kind of sounds like the Fiends to me.
You want to start off, Steve, with your...
Sure, I will be happy to.
Sure.
The title of the book is My Guardian Angels. And there have been so many events in my life that God has intervened through his guardian angels to keep me alive, and more often than I certainly deserve. But the first time that I was very aware of my guardian angel intervening in my life to save it was when I was in college. I majored in college in sleep deprivation. So I'm coming home late one night, down a curvy road, and then there was a 5-mile straightaway. And at the end of it, there was a lady standing out in the middle of the road in a white dress that was road length all the way down to her feet, waving her arms for me to stop. And I slam on the brakes just as the car is going off of the road down over the bank. And I got out of the car to go see if I had hit the woman. And, of course, she wasn't there. And another event happened very near this same place about 2 weeks later. And the same lady was standing out in the middle of the road waving her arms for me to stop. And again, I had fallen asleep and I was going over the bank, but I put on the brakes to keep from hitting her. So that was the first time that I remember being aware of my guardian angel actually being there to intervene and preventing me from a catastrophic accident. And there have been so many other incidents that have happened in my life, but most of them involved flying incidents. And they, of course, began when I was learning to fly at the Asheville-Hendersonville Airport. And one of them I can remember vividly started my first night flight. And I was in a tri-pacer, and a cold front had just come through Asheville. And Piedmont had oversold 3 soldiers who were going to Tri-City. And I had never flown at night before. And if you took the mileage string on the map and you measured the mileage to Tri-City from the Asheville-Hendersonville Airport, I had plenty of time before dark to get there. Except that a cold front had just come through, and it was about a 50 to 60 mile an hour wind howling across the tops of the hills. And I get to Tri-City, and I see a long string of red lights on the ground. And I'm thinking, it was in the fall, and I'm thinking to myself, there must be a circus down there or something. And now my clock runs out, and I am lost. And I'm circling a city that is on a river, and I'm talking to the Tri-City Tower, and I'm saying to him, I'm lost, I don't know where I am, and he said, well, tune in your VOR and tell me what radio you're on. I said, what's a VOR? And they said, well, look out to your left, and you'll see a Piedmont DC-3 flashing his lights. I see this airplane out to my left. He's flashing his lights, and he says, now just follow that Piedmont DC-3 back into the airport. Well, lo and behold, I am flying right across that string of red lights to the airport. And needless to say, I spent the night in Tri-City. But that was another time that the guardian angel took care of me. There was another time when I was working at the airport. We had a contract with the ATF. That was the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Tax organization that monitored moonshine whiskey makers. And so they came to us one day and they said, we need to be at daylight in the morning, we need to be on top of this particular mountain because we've had information that they're going to be making whiskey at this site, And if we see the smoke there, we want to be over there, and we'll direct somebody from the ground to come in and pick them up. I get over the hill on the lee side of the mountain, and I see the smoke coming up just over the crest of the mountain, and I am right in the treetops, and the people on the ground see me. And this one person goes over near a tree, and he pulls something standing up off of the tree that is a gun, and he points it at us, and the agent who was sitting in the J3 Cub behind me said, "Let's get out of here quick. And when we get back to the airport, I see a hole in the bottom of the wing that was not 10 feet, maybe 10 to 12 feet from where we were sitting in that J3 Cub. And the fabric is all the way off of the top of the wing, all the way back to the trailing edge. And we had been shot at and almost done in. And that was the guardian angel again that caused that gun to miss us. And a little side note of this story is that the next morning I open up the airport and I've got the keys and I'm opening up the gas pits. And this car is sitting there. Somebody gets out of the car and comes over to me and says, "I want to talk to that pilot that was flying that airplane," pointing out to the J3 Cub that we were in the day before. And I said, "He's off today. He's not going to be here today." So he said, "Well, you," and the guy said, "Well, you tell him if he comes back across that hill again, we're not going to miss him."
Oh my God!
Again, the guardian angel.
Oh my God!
Another flight. When I was in Charlotte, I was so eager to fly that I would tell false information about my experience just to get to fly an airplane. But I was flying Martin 404s, and we had a guy his name was Jinx Caldwell, and he refurbished airplanes and resold them. He bought a Martin 202 from TWA that was in San Francisco, and he asked me if I'd go get it and bring it back. And I said, sure. Well, it was a dumb thing to do. Unpressurized, clearly a two-pilot airplane. And I'm jumping in the thing and firing it by myself. And we had to make a stop at Hill Air Force Base in Utah and pick up a load of parts. So I'm flying unpressurized, and I got up to 13,000 feet, which is a minimum route altitude across there. And it's now nighttime. I'm going to land at nighttime at Hill Air Force Base. I had charts, and I had the I could figure out where the approach, but I had to maintain 13,000 feet until I got over the outer marker, and then follow the holding pattern down to the minimum altitude for the approach. And I made a couple of turns. And I thought something said in the back of my mind said, "You just swing out to the east one time, and you won't have to make but one more turn." So something in the back of my mind said, "Don't do it. Just stay with this holding pattern and fly the approach according to this approach chart." I did. We landed fine. Got up the next morning, and I looked out to the east, and my knees went weak. If I had swung that holding pattern out to the east just a little bit, I would have flown right into the mountains. Another savior by my guardian angel. And, of course, you all know about 855. And that was an incident that... I should have known how to get that engine started so much earlier than I did. And I did know. But my mind was so cluttered with everything going on, all the radio communication, flight attendants, other crew members coming up and talking. And finally, when there was nothing else to do except wait on water contact, I turned to Dudley and I said, Dudley, let's try that number two engine one more time. And, of course, you know the end of the story. We got it started. But that was a time where God intervened in my life to keep us from starting that engine when we did. And excuse me. And the one time that we lived in Charlotte, my wife and I, we had three children, and we decided we'd go to Mexico City for about a 4 or 5 day vacation. We did. And we were coming back. We were going to go from Mexico City to New Orleans to Kennedy Airport, Idlewild, and then catch a DC-7 from there back to Charlotte through Richmond. Well, normally there is a tailwind from New Orleans to Idlewild Airport of probably an average of 40, 50 miles an hour. Well, this particular day there was a headwind, which is just almost unheard of 40 to 50 miles an hour from New Orleans to Idlewild. And we get to Idlewild, and we're about almost an hour late getting there. And we get off the airplane, and now we're going to have to really hustle through customs and to get through in time to make our flight to Charlotte, because we had to go take the shuttle bus all the way around the terminals to the eastern terminal. But when we got there, Glenda, my wife, called my sister, who was babysitting our children, and told her that we'd be on flight 663 that day coming into Charlotte. So we get on the shuttle bus, and we get around to the TWA terminal, and somebody had parked a car right in the driveway and abandoned it. And we had to sit there for about 15 or 20 minutes until somebody came out and moved that car. So we get to the terminal building, the eastern terminal building, and we get there just as we see the airplane, the DC-7 to Charlotte, pulling away from the gate. And then the agent said, well, you can go, you can pass ride on the helicopter. There's a flight out of Newark to Charlotte. You can catch that flight. And so we get to Newark Terminal, and we get over there, and we show him our tickets, the agent, who I recognize. And he looked at him and said, oh, you're going to Charlotte? He says, well, it's a good thing you weren't on 663 out of Kennedy. I said, why? He said, well, because it's in the ocean and everybody died on it. Well, all of the many things that happened that day to spare our lives, and our guardian angels were, again, very, very busy taking care of us. So with that, I will turn it over to somebody else and let them share their stories with you.
Neil, this is Jim. This is Jim. Does someone else have something before me?
It's Jim Graybill. Jim, I got a couple of
Jim
things.
Jim Graybill. Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
This is back in 1960, early part of 62, and I had just carried on with Eastern. I was flying a co-pilot on Martin 404, and we were in coming from Atlanta to Newark. I'm sorry, from Atlanta. I came to talk tonight, Neil. Coming from Washington out to Charlie West, and we had about, I guess, I don't know, half load of passengers. Now, all the captains that I'd been flown with just totally hated to turn that auto feather switch on. You remember? And you guys remember that auto feather switch on that Martin?
Sure do.
Anyway, we were taking off out of Charter West, and thank goodness it was a clear day. And the captain had that, that auto feather switch on. And I know, we were just ready to break ground. And all of a sudden, the right engine burped. That was all it was. And boy, right into a feather it went. Just hadn't got enough speed to, you know, make this thing fly. We wound up going down. You all remember the river there in Charlotte West?
Yep.
Coming off the end of the runway, you know, going down, coming around the Capitol. We were looking up at Capitol. Anyway, we got back around and landed, and that kind of got my attention. Another thing, there you go. You were talking about your guardian angel. I don't know where you could call this a guardian angel or whatever, but I was in a hospital there in Savannah, and I thought I was getting out, and anyway, they were coming out of an operation, and I remember looking over and kissing my wife, and all of a sudden, I kind of felt funny, and it was almost like you were coming out of your body. I haven't told many people about this. After what you just got to demonstrate, I'm going to have to tell this one. All of a sudden, and I say all of a sudden, I don't know how much time elapsed, but I was kind of up on the ceiling looking down at myself laying on the ground, laying on the gurney there. And I had a younger sister that she was 4 and I was 5, and long story short, she was killed. And I thought to myself, well, I guess that's the way I'm going to look in the funeral home. And whatever reason, I turned, or I thought I turned, and here's this little hand holding out as much to say, no, it's not time. And from that, I went back to my body. But I've told this a couple of times in private, and I don't think anybody believes me. But anyway, hey, Steve, after what you were saying there, I think I had a guardian angel that day.
Anyway.
Okay, very interesting. And I'm sure we've had some experiences, but it sounds like you guys... truly, you had guardian angels, that's for sure.
Hey, Neil?
Yes.
Bob Furman.
Hey, Bob.
Can I say something here? Would this be an appropriate time?
Yes, it would be.
What a pleasure to know y'all, and a great honor to be part of the Eastern family. Now, if y'all got a pencil and paper... Every one of you that's told a great story about God needs to write it down. And we can put it on Message of Truth if you want to. .com. That's what it's all about. Because if you've got pencils and paper, I want you to write this website down. Neil knows me. Some of you do. I'm Bob Furman. My last name is spelled F-U-H-R-M-A-N. So if you go to bobfurman.com, that's www.bobfurman.com. I'll give it one more time. www.bobfurman.com. And I'm privileged to have a story that's something similar to all of yours that's so true on how God's taken care of us at Eastern, just like he did Eddie Rickenbacker. You'll see it there on the website. I just put a lot of this together after a couple of weeks of working hard on this website to bring all the documents up that I've been provided by other Eastern employees like George Jen and all the help that Neil's done. But it's there for us. And you'll see it. It's a similar story to what you're all talking about. And God in Christ has never forgotten us in Matthew 6:33 like he didn't forget Eddie Rickenbacker and his men on who are lost at sea. So please take a look at it. Let Neil know what you think. you can get a hold of me at a P.O. box there on the contact list at bobfurman.com or by the email. And that's all I want to say, Neil. God bless you. God has not forgotten us over the last 25 years. He's been with us every inch of the way. Thank you, Neil.
Certainly has, and he's kept the family of the Eastern together, and we're all happy about that, of course. Any other comments? I think I heard some folks that wanted to talk about something that's on your mind.
Yeah, Neil, this is Jim.
Jim, go ahead.
Cecile, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Why don't you go ahead?
Okay, real quickly, I want to bring everybody up to date what's going on with our first Eastern Airlines flight, and as Neil calls us, we're ambassadors. We are completely booked on the first flight, which seats 150. We have a standby list going. We have 20 on the standby list. So just keep sending Neil. If you want to be on the flight, we could probably try to get two planes. And it's going. We don't know the time or the date, rather, or when all this is going to occur. I sent out an email today to all those that are confirmed. If you didn't send an email from me, that's because you're not confirmed. If for some reason we don't have your email and had sent your name in, just email Neil and we'll double-check it. We also sent an email to the standby passengers, and it will be by first come, first serve on the standby. As we get cancellations, which we anticipate we will put you on the flight. And all the emails have been enthusiasm. And like Neil said, we're ambassadors. We have great ambassadors out there, and the enthusiasm is fantastic. I got a lot of confirmations today from the blast email that we sent out to the 150 passengers, and the excitement is unbelievable. Like Mr. Furman said, we are a family, and we continue to be one great family. Thank you, Neil. Back to you, Jim. I want to hear your stories.
Okay. Thank you very much, Cecile. I have a couple of stories. Number one is after I left the ticket counter at Hartford Springfield, BDL it's called, I went to New Haven as city sales manager and having my own airport, my own city ticket office, and 275 travel agents. Well, I was there probably 8 months when the company said, Jim, we want you in Washington. So I went to Washington. My office was in National Airport, and my dear lady secretary was Maggie Owsley. And I know that Skip Selinger and John McCorkle and a bunch before me really enjoyed Maggie's help in the office. But before I got there, I'd just like you to all know that I had just built a brand new home in the hills, western hills of Connecticut, just west of I-91. It was old town of Summers, Connecticut. I built a beautiful 17th century salt box and in the middle of an orchard of 33 apple trees. I bought the whole thing, including the brand new home, for $28,000. It was just so beautiful. But when the company called and said, Jim, we want you to go from Washington to the New York office, I said, oh, my goodness. I said, I don't have enough equity in my home. Would you mind if I fly every day that I'm going to be in the city from Hartford to New York? And they said, no problem. And so they gave me a C-1 pass, and I rode from Bradley on a DC-7. In fact, I did it so much that the flight attendants had my coffee and a warm Danish pastry ready for me every morning. Well, that left at 7 o'clock. I got to Newark Airport at about 7:30, 7:45. Bus number 107 took me to the Port Authority building, and from there I walked to the office at 10 Rockefeller Plaza. I did this for a number of times, and remember, I was at the time employed at the home office as sort of a jack of all trades. They had me doing so many things. I would go from the home office to London, Paris, Frankfurt, to open offices. I would go to Miami to speak to interline groups there. I went with Mr. George Gordon, who was our vice president of marketing at the time, to Toronto to take part in the discussion about the biggest move that it was really the first move in the airline industry, where we moved 15,000 dealers and distributors from the Massey Ferguson Heavy Equipment Manufacturing Company from all of these different locations in the U.S. and Canada to Mexico City. And you can't believe the things that came up. Don Greffey was the director of sales, Mexico City. Don would call me one day and say, "Hey, Jim, we got a trainload of brand new, beautiful, equipment they use in the fields for harvesting and so on. They were on the train, and the Mexicans would not let it go into Mexico. And Don said, "Well, Jim, listen, give me $10,000. I said, "You got it." And so he paid off the proper people to let the train load of machinery into Mexico City. And, of course, we had to promise that it would be going out after the Massey Ferguson program. Well, to continue, someone said, "Jim, we've got to have some entertainment from these ladies and gentlemen." It was a three-week program. They were going to be there one day. They were going to have beautiful parties and so on, stay overnight, and leave the third day to go back to where they came from. So I had to have 159 passenger stretch DC-8s. And I had to have them leaving from, I think it was something, we had to move 15,000 people. And so they were from all of these different locations. I can remember getting a telephone call early in the morning from Mac McLaughlin. Mac used to be the convention manager for the West Palm Beach crew. Well, Matt called and said, "Hey, Jim, I'm shivering." I said, "Where are you?" He said, "I'm in Saskatoon." He said, "It's so cold up here." Matt, now remember, is a Miami boy. He said, "Can I buy a pair of gloves and a scarf or something?" I said, "Please, go ahead and do it." I said, "Listen, how about all of the liquor in the airplane? It's loaded with liquor." He said, "I'm in the line shack of a man here, and he's going to look at it for me." I said, "Give him $20, please, and have him look for it." Well, everything seemed to go well. Matt got back. The airplane got back. And then everything was just going so smoothly. And this is because we had a meeting prior to the whole operation with Frank Sharp, with Bill Cambray, and with food services. We all met in Boston to pre-plan this whole event. Well, anyway, we got almost to the end of the program. I should say before that, Don Greffey called me. He says, "Jim, I need some more money." I said, "What do you need it for?" He said, "I got to pay off the daytime customs people." He said, "Can you send me $10,000? I said, "Sure." So I did it, and he paid off the customs people, and we were able to clear a 159-passenger airplane in something like 30 minutes, baggage and everything. No one looked at anything. Well, okay, that went well. Oh, and by the way, Eddie Arnold was the one that we hired, and I paid Eddie Arnold $1,000 a day for 18 days to entertain our people. Midway through the program, we had a 2 or 3 day break in the program. Eddie came to me and said, "Jim, listen, He said, my wife and I have never been to Acapulco. Could you make a plan to get us there? And I said, sure, Eddie. So I did that. When they came back, they were just overwhelmed. They said, oh, my goodness, what a beautiful trip. Eddie said, Jim, what can I do for you? I said, well, my young grandson loves you, Eddie Arnold. If you could just maybe sign an autograph and give it to me. He said, listen, I'll do more than that. He said, come on up to my room. So I went up to his hotel room, and he said, I guess you don't know that I have been learning German, and we are now marketing my my programs, my songs in Germany. And he said, I want to give you a little smattering of what it was. And you know, here I am in Eddie Arnold's hotel room, and he puts his foot up on the bed. He's got his guitar in his hand, and he starts singing to me in German. It was fantastic. It was just one of those things. Well, anyway, we're getting toward the end of the program. It was supposed to last a total of 15, 18 days. I'm going back now to 1963 or a little later. Anyway, we're toward the end of the program, and I got a telephone call from Montreal. And they said, Jim, we got a little bit of a problem up here. It's flight number 110, the last flight of the whole shebang. And he said, Jim, I'm sorry, we've got a mechanical up here. I said, what's it amount to? He says, no more than 10 hours. I said, okay, do your best, please. To date, well, the airplane came in to Mexico City Airport 9 hours later. Of course, that's daylight, nighttime. We had paid off the daytime people and not the nighttime. Well, anyway, when the airplane came in, they revaccinated 39 people, and everything went smoothly beyond that point. But when you think about this, for a $1 million deal, the first big deal that Eastern Airlines ever had like this, I tell you, I think it went damn well. And that's my story, Neil.
Well, Jim, wonderful. And, you know, chartering also was a great a profit center for Eastern Airlines. And as we know, the new Eastern Airlines will start off with a charter operation. And we hope the first charter of the new Eastern Airlines will be 150 plus or minus people of former Eastern Airlines folks that will be on that flight from Miami to San Juan. So we look forward to that very first charter. I do have something I want to talk about before it gets too late in our show. We have Bob Furman has been on the show. I think he's still with us.
I'm here.
And also George Jen. George lost a very close friend tonight, this morning at about 12:30 this morning. George, would you like to talk about Skip Copeland?
I would. Thank you, Neil. I appreciate it. And it wasn't just me who lost a good friend, although he was a very, very close friend of mine. All of the Eastern employees lost someone who was very, very, very dedicated to all of the Eastern employees, and that was Skip Copeland. It was funny. I met Skip. I was probably 25 or 26 years old, and I was flying a second officer on this trip. And we started talking during the flight. We had both grown up in New York, and actually about five streets apart. And Skip was about 11 years older than I am. And he said, well, how did you used to get to school? And I said, well, I told him that it was 9 blocks from my home to grammar school. I used to walk it. He said, oh, you know, he said, I think I beat you up a couple of times and took your lunch money. Well, after that, we became really good friends. And, in fact, we served 6 years together on Eastern MEC for the pilots from the New York base. And as you know, Skip was the master chairman of the Eastern MEC when it closed down in 91. And I don't know if he ever really recovered from that. His health went steadily downhill. I don't know if it wasn't for a certain person named Mary Ann that he would have probably left us 5 years ago. But she took such good care of them. And yesterday my wife was flying in from Europe. I tell you, you talk about, I believe it was Steve spoke about his guardian angel. And her flight was due in at 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon. And in the morning I got a text from her, and she told me that the flight was running approximately 3 hours late. And about 5 minutes later, Mary Ann called me, and I said, how is Skip doing? Because the last time I spoke with her, he was undergoing radiation treatment. He had cancer in his sinus. And she said the pain had disappeared. He was eating well. He was doing much better. And she said, well, he's back in the hospital. I said, what is he back in the hospital for? And she said, well, from the radiation treatment, he contracted pneumonia. And the doctors say it doesn't look very good. So because my wife's flight, and I was picking her up at the airport at Kennedy, because her flight was running late, I said, well, where is he? And she told me at Stony Brook University Hospital, and I hopped in my car and went out there immediately. And I got to spend 3 hours with Skip and two of his children and Mary Ann. And Skip couldn't speak because he was on a life support system, but he was awake. And, we devised a way to communicate. And it was very, very sad because his kidneys were failing, his liver was failing. And Mary Ann pulled me aside and said, I don't think he's going to make it through the night. So I stayed there until about 6:30, 7 o'clock last night, and just kind of conversed with him. It was a one-way conversation for the most part, and talked about some of the old times, some of the great times we had flying together. And anyway, then I left to go to the airport, and as you know, Skip passed away. Last night at 12:30.
George, if you don't mind, because Skip was so much a part of your great book, and I say great book because it is, Final Destination Disaster, What Really Happened to Eastern Airlines by George Jenn, and a great deal of that book was about you and your friend, Skip Copeland. What a wonderful way to give tribute to Skip Copeland as what you have done in your book. And so ably you've done it that I'd like to read a story, just not a real short one, but what you wrote about what had happened to Eastern Airlines. And also, Bob Furman has written he didn't write it, but he recorded it, because it's an old hymn that he'd like to dedicate to those folks that remembered Eastern Flight 980, the crash in La Paz. And, George, you wrote this in your epilogue, and I think it's time to reflect back then, because you and Skip Copeland did so much to try to bring out the things that happened to Eastern Airlines that should not have happened. But I'm reading from your book, and you say, now that Eastern is history and its management scattered to the wind, a few of us who were friends of Larry Campbell, that was the captain of the ill-fated Flight 980, have gotten together to see if perhaps we can tie up some loose ends. And as a former ALPA official, I have been asked to contact the NTSB officer in charge of the investigation. I suppose what is most troubling about the crash aftermath is the way the matter was handled, or wasn't handled. A jetliner with 19 passengers and 10 crew simply disappears and is never seen or heard of again until 10 months later when an NTSB team makes it up to the crash site, by which time most of the bits and pieces have been buried in time and in by the new snow that happens there often. Even more troublesome, no bodies or body parts were ever seen by the various parties who made it to the crash site. So allow me to ask the following questions. It has been said that the demise of Flight 980 was the first in the history of the NTSB and predecessor agencies never fully looked into for cause. Is that true or false? You asked the NTSB. NTSB investigators had flown down to La Paz the day after the crash, but no NTSB investigators even went up to the mountain. The only people who went up were a group of Peruvian mountain climbers who returned with parts of the wreckage, but no photographs. Under NTSB procedure, only board investigators are able to handle such wreckage. Who authorized them, and why did the NTSB sit this one out? A few months later, a second team, hired by another Eastern Airlines pilot who knew some of the cabin crew, went up to the mountain and filmed the wreckage. Then in June, Judith Kelly, the widow of one of the dead and missing passengers, with a trained mountaineer guide, made it up to the crash site and also shot pictures. Yet the NTSB persisted in maintaining the site was inaccessible. Your comments, please, NTSB. ALPA has in its possession documents in which Gregory Faith, the NTSB investigator heading the October 1985 expedition, is quoted as saying he wanted to return to the crash site, perhaps to try and recover the flight and voice recorders. However, no further attempt was made. And I wonder, why wasn't there? Is it possible those recording devices might have been retrieved earlier by parties unknown? In the absence of any explanation for the aircraft's demise, how did the NTSB account for the loss of the 727-200 with 19 passengers plus crew of 10? Cause unknown? Has it ever reached such a conclusion in any other airline disaster? How would you, as a seasoned crash investigator, account for the total absence of bodies, body parts, bloodstains on the snow? The altitude was too high to sustain predatory life. No bones were found by the October 1985 search team. What happened to the doomed passengers? In the absence of any formal explanation by Eastern, what does your gut instinct tell you about the disaster? For a while, Eastern Airline publicist hinted at pilot error, but then wisely backed off when asked for evidence. At this point, even a calculated guess might provide some comfort to Larry's friends. Did the NTSB make any sort of after-action report to the FAA following its November 1985 attempt to reach the crash site? This is assuming the FAA was even curious. Mr. Young, we would truly appreciate hearing from you, officially or otherwise. The death of our colleagues remains like an open wound that might begin to heal with answers pointing to probable cause. So far, the information given out by the government has been less than forthright. Cordially, George Jen. George,
yes,
I commend you. I commend you on the book that you have written. It just absolutely is a stunning revelation of events that led up to this great airline no longer. However, we do have a new one to look forward to. And I'd like to add also, Bob Perman has sang this song. He's a great singer. And so, Bob, if you don't mind, I'll play this song that you've dedicated to the Flight 980, which made a great deal, part of a great deal of George's book.
Neil, could I just interject one thing here?
Yes, George.
Even though that letter was written sometime after I had left Eastern and quite a few years after the crash, I never received the courtesy of a reply. So just so our listeners know that.
Well, I think there's some things that are going on now that perhaps we might have some resolution here, George. I certainly hope, because Bob has done a great deal in his efforts on so many things that have happened in the past with Eastern Airlines and its employees, that we were never really given the full consideration of not only the NTSB but our federal government as well. But before we talk any more, let me play this beautiful song that Bob sings with his guitar.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I was lost and now I'm found. I was blind and now I see. It was grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious it is
song.
Very nice.
Very good. We won't forget those that died in that crash, and we won't forget Eastern Airlines because it has become a legacy airline. And to change the subject, I'd like to suggest that all of our folks listening, especially those people in South Florida, consider going down to welcome the new airline and its first airplane, the Boeing 737-800, which I think is supposed to arrive December the 19th. And if anyone has any additional information of a date that is earlier or later than, let us know. But I plan to come down and be part of that activity. And a lot of folks there, I think, Jim, in your area, and Cecile, your area are close by. It would be a good idea to consider getting there to welcome the new Eastern Airlines airplane. Hopefully we'll use that airplane, same airplane, an additional one. I hope we can book the additional airplane to fly to San Juan.
Right, Neil, and if everybody will just keep emailing you on the website, dalradioshow.com, so we can put you on the standby list, and hopefully we'll get another plane, and our ambassadors will make this airline, the new Eastern Airlines, the same as the old great Eastern Airlines was, because it is loved throughout the world. I know it's loved in South America, and it's loved throughout the United States. Everybody that I've told is coming back, they go, great, when does it start? So let's keep sending the emails to Neil, and we'll get you on that list, and hopefully we'll get two planes.
Oh, that would be great.
We're going to have fun in San Juan. So.
Absolutely.
Okay?
I had my little brother from South Florida call me and said he had listened to our shows, and he said, hey, can I get a seat on that airplane, my wife and I? And I said, well, I don't know. We can't pull any strings for you, Gary. You call in a little bit late, but we do have 150 people on the airplane, and we do have a waiting list. So, hopefully we won't have that many cancellations, and hopefully we'll have another airplane to pack that airplane, and we'll have two airplanes going to San Juan. Be a great time to meet and greet our friends that we haven't seen in many years. Let's see. I've got a couple of other things. Anyone else have anything that you want to talk about? Eastern Airlines is flying flight attendants, by the way. So I've seen several people that have emailed me and wanting to know about being an Eastern flight attendant. And by golly, you can go to the Eastern Airlines website, and they do have a career page there, I believe, and you can apply for a flight attendant's position. Wow, I wish they do hire guys. So my age has caught up with me. So I'd love to be a flight attendant on the new Eastern Airlines. That would be a great privilege to take care of passengers again. Let's see. Any additional things we want to talk about? First flight, we've talked about that. Oh, by the way, Cecile, I might mention that we are going to send out a form to fill out and send email back to us, by the way, of your information that Cecile has already started to gather.
Yeah.
And it will be a kind of a reservations for the flight. And also the expenses of the hotel and all the expenses that will be associated with this first flight.
Hello, Neil. This is Jim.
Hey,
hello.
Jim. Yeah, Jim.
Yeah,
ahead.
I thought maybe you had cut me off because I was waiting for your cutoff program, okay?
You always remind me of that. I don't want to cut off. You know, every time we have one of these shows, Jim, Monday nights, it's kind of like suiting up to go out on another flight. And if I were in maintenance, it's kind of like taking my toolbox back out to the airport. Or if I were in any other department, it would be a great time to get in the car, crank it up, and go to work for Eastern Airlines. And that's what Monday night feels like to me. I don't know about you folks, but that's the way I look at it. And it's a great time to remember Eastern.
Neil, what do you want me to do with that email of mine?
We're going to put it down. We're going to get it right, Jim Graybill. But now I finally found the button for Horace Welk. Good night, Joe. Jim,
Neil,
Jim Hart.
There's a sign-off music. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. I would love to take us out of here right now. Certainly, it's unusual. And we'd love to have all of our people with us. We'll be back with you next week. Same time, same station, with www.ealradio.com. And we like maybe one of our popular commercials for Eastern. We've all had one of our fantastic commercials from Eastern. And like one of our popular stations, we hope you're with Eastern here at EIL Radio. And we'd love to have you with us. We hope you'll once again buy Eastern Radio. And next week, Eastern News will once again fly Eastern Radio. Eastern history and talk and about radio employees and so on. Friends of Eastern, please be sure to be with us at Eastern employees and radio friends of Eastern. Be sure to be with us at Eastern. Be sure to be with us next year, next week, and when we are about to touch. Thanks,
Jim Hart. Jim Hart, we love you, and you do a fantastic job. It's great that you sign us off. We love to hear you sign us off. Yeah. My associate producer says, hugs to Jim Hart.
Thanks, Neil. I tell you, my vision is a problem right now.
Oh, it's great. But as Jim said, good night, Eastern family. Good night.
Good night,
good night
Eastern
all.
Family.
Good night, all.
Good night. Yeah.